or F. That's it. It's just bottom line. It's the same type of way that we've seen throughout, if you watch some of the popular TV shows, at one point somewhat popular, The Undercover Boss. Have you ever seen The Undercover Boss before? This show where a boss, an executive, will dress up like his or her employees and go in without the employees knowing about it and act like them and see how they respond to difficult situations. And at the end, reward is offered to the ones that pass it successfully. It's a fascinating show, pretty interesting if it's ever happened to you where you think, boy, this guy's being really nice or he's being really inquisitive. I'm not really sure if he's for real. There was a book written by a guy who decided to check out Christianity. And this guy went to Liberty University, which is in Virginia, and checked out to see if these Christians were everything that they say or claim to be. And it was interesting, as you would read through the book, Unlikely Disciple, you'll find out that this man was very fascinated by everything that they did. He went to prayer group, he had an accountability partner, he actually sang in the choir. He was the very last person to ever interview Jerry Falwell, the founder of Liberty University, last known before Jerry Falwell died. So he had all of this, and he went to Brown University, which is not pro-Christian. It's anything but that. And he was trying to check it out, and he left with some really amazing impressions. And so people didn't know the test was going on, but the test went on. And in some ways, some passed. But he noted that Christianity is better than non-Christianity in the fact that most of the kids are serious about their work. He said, but there's still a group that parties. You can still go out and do whatever you want to with the Christian group from Liberty, just like I can from Brown University. There's no difference in certain groups. And so I'm aware tonight that you can come to church, Family Baptist, and you can give the impression, because you're spending an evening, a Sunday evening here, that you are one who has passed this test and that Christ is in you, that you're a born-again believer. But the reality is God knows, he can see right into your heart, and I want you to open up your eyes to what the Scripture has to say and ask the Holy Spirit to direct your thoughts and your mind as it deals with this passage. Now, we're looking at 2 Corinthians. The 2 Corinthians is a unique book because it deals with the second book that's written here. Buddy, do you know how to read? You can hand him, maybe you can help him. 2 Corinthians chapter 13, okay? So 2 Corinthians is the second book written to the church in Corinth, and he's writing this one. It was probably the third letter Paul wrote. We know that from reading through the book of Corinthians, 2 Corinthians. But here, the 2 Corinthians, he's writing and defending his apostleship. If you go back and you look at the books, 1 and 2 Corinthians, you'll find that it was written to a very carnal church, which means a church that was full of people that claimed to be believers but really lived the way they wanted to live when they thought no one else was looking. They were involved in all sorts of sins. Anything that Corinth had to offer, it was actually found within the church. That was a great concern. And to get an idea of how bad things were and to get a context, if you scan down with me, if you're looking in your Bible at 2 Corinthians 13, look at chapter 12. Look at that very last verse. I believe it's verse 21. It will kind of set the stage for us. Paul says, "Lest when I come again, my God will humble me among you, and I shall mourn for many who have sinned before and have not repented of the uncleanness," he lists, "fornication and lewdness which they have practiced." He's saying, I'm bothered that I'm going to come back, I'm going to find out the same problems are still very evident in the church that is right in front of me. And so he breaks down these next couple of verses. Look at verse 1 of 2 Corinthians 13. "This will be the third time I am coming to you by the mouth of two or three witnesses. Every word shall be established." He loves to throw in Old Testament truth in the midst of talking. He's saying, you've got to get this because I'm telling you this the third time. And the Old Testament says that in the mouth of two or three, there's truth. And I'm telling you the truth right now. "I have told you before and foretell as if I were present the second time. And now being absent, I write to those who have sinned before and to all the rest, that if I come again, I will not spare. Since you seek a proof of Christ speaking in me, who is not weak towards you, but mighty in you, for though he was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by power of God, for we also are weak in him, but we shall live with him by the power of God towards you. Now, in those four verses, packed full of rich theological truth, the thought of Jesus crucified in weakness, what in the world is going on there? The fact that Paul is saying, I'm coming to you and I'm speaking the truth, but I'm giving you this as a backdrop because I want us to focus primarily on verse 5. And that's the one that you're going to see up here, and you're going to keep seeing this. And I want this verse, I'm hoping, to get ingrained in your own heart and mind as we start to look at this passage. Look what it says. It says in verse 5, examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you are disqualified? I want to read that again, and I want you to get this because this is where we're going to just focus in on tonight. Examine yourselves. Here's a test. As to whether you are in the faith, test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you are disqualified? Now, to finish the paragraph, verse 6 says, but I trust that you will know that we are not disqualified. The hope here is that as I preach this to you and as I relay verse 5 to you, my hope is not to scare you into another decision. I'm hoping you pass this test. It's a test you can pass in Christ. But I'm afraid that the reality is, in a group this size, someone in here needs to check their own heart and see whether or not they're in the faith. The test is these three things that we're going to look at together. First of all, it's personal. And you can get that from verse 5 as you look at how many times it's referenced to you, yourselves. You need to do this, see if you pass this test. Second of all, it's factual. It's not something based on a changing standard. The standard remains the same and has always been the gospel of Jesus Christ. The death, burial, and resurrection. Do you embrace that? Are you in the faith? Is Christ in you? It's factual. And that is so important because if you look outside of this church, you will see around five churches within a three-block radius. Have you noticed that? Have you ever wondered what's up with all these churches? I'm from Greenville, South Carolina, the Bible Belt buckle, right? The buckle of the Bible Belt. That's what everyone calls it. And they keep saying, why are there all these churches and what's the point? Well, some of the churches are there because of splits in churches, because we've got sinful people in churches. And I don't know a church that doesn't have sinful people in it, right? And some of them are a result of different doctrine being taught. You can go down the road and you can find a false doctrine being taught. And I think it's absolutely appropriate and necessary for pastors to call out false teachers and heretics. I don't think it's appropriate for me to take difference with the church down the road if they're preaching the gospel, but I just don't like something about what they're doing as far as their method. But when it comes to the truth, if they get that wrong, we should speak it out without being ashamed. But there's all these things. I want you to know this. It's not about what this pastor says or that pastor says or that pastor says or what that evangelist says. It's what does the Bible say? And we're going to look at the fact of the word. And that should give you great hope. Because it's not about me convincing you of something. I'm just going to show you the scripture. Okay? And then you can make up your mind, accept it or reject it. But I also want you to know this. It's unavoidable. You may not want it. The only way you're going to avoid it, here is it. The only way you're going to avoid this is if you get up while I'm speaking and you walk out. Okay? So if you do that, that's what I'm going to guess is happening. Now, at college, if someone falls asleep on me, I kick them out of class. I'm a loving guy. Really loving. Now, I just do that with the freshmen. And all that has to happen is one time someone falls asleep. I will not do that here, I promise. That wouldn't go over very well, you know, a guest speaker. And you're avoiding the test? Dude, Trinity, come on. No, okay, all right, you'll be back, okay. So let's look at just the simplicity of this verse and try to understand the context. The test is personal. I want you to see this. Look at this verse and understand what it's saying here about how personal it is. It says, first of all, examine yourselves, right? Then I want you to notice it goes on to say, test yourselves. So it says, examine yourselves. Then it says, test yourselves. Now, I want to note a difference here. If you look at this in the New King James, we have examine comes first, then test. If any of you happens to have an ESV on you, it reverses these, and it puts first test and then examine. And then you say, well, that's the point. Let's get on the same page. Well, that's not what I'm trying to emphasize tonight. I'm trying to emphasize that we have two words. They're different words. They're speaking similar messages, but there is a difference, and I want to note the difference just briefly with you. This first examine is a test that you can pass. It's the same Greek word as found in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, that talks about that God is not going to give you a test that you can't handle, but will, with every test or temptation, provide you a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Okay, there's a potential that you can pass this. So Paul starts out very positively, and then in verse 6 he says, I don't want you to fall into this one of being disqualified. So this is a test that you think you can pass. The second one, test yourself, is the idea of going under scrutiny that you may miss on your own. It's more intense look at your heart, and usually it involves the help of someone else. But here Paul is saying, I want you to do this yourself. So first, it starts out with this assumption, I know you all think that you passed this test even before I begin it. But then he says, Church of Corinth, really, seriously, examine every part of this. And so now I just reversed it, so let me do that again. Examine, it's something you can pass, but test it, because I don't know if you get this right. Here's an illustration. When I was doing some studies, we had the professor say something to me about, I want you to turn to the person next to you and ask them the question, first, give them how you think you're perceived. Okay, so give your own perception of yourself to others. So how would you do that? If you were to do this right now, turn to the person next to you and say, this is how I think I come across. So I went on to say, well, I'm a nice guy. I love hanging out with people, and I'm open to other people's opinions, and I started to go through all this thing, and I was waxing eloquent in who I was. Pride does that, right? The guy sitting next to me, I will never forget it, Edward T. Franklin III, turns to me and says, I'll tell you how you come across right when you walk in. You're cocky, you're really tall, and you don't look like you belong here. I was like, what? Are you serious? And then we really started to talk. You know, like at heart level. What am I doing that's giving you that impression that I'm cocky or that I don't belong? Or I was talking about coming back off of vacation at Hilton Head. I didn't mention that it was because my relatives have a house that they rented and they invited us to come. I just said, I just came from Hilton Head. Everyone's like, oh, rich white kid, you know? And, you know, just like snobby type of deal. And I would go on to talk about different places I've been and traveled. And I wasn't thinking about how this was perceived. It was really confronting to hear him say, now that's really how you are. So when you think of these two words, I'm going to challenge you. Do you think that you passed this test? Are you in the faith? Is Christ in you? My guess is you're going to say, yep, I pass. Okay, stop. Slow down. Do you really pass this test? Now, how are we going to find out if you pass the test? Well, I want you to note that it is personal, because he goes on to say, do you not know yourselves? Again, yourself. Is Christ in you? Unless indeed you are disqualified. If you don't make it personal, then you're missing out on the power behind what Paul is saying. He's saying, quit looking to your relatives, quit looking to mom and dad and all of this, but get real. Do you match up? Now, I love to do this in trying to figure out if everyone matches up and getting real. I ask people to go through a series of questions to see if you are actually in the faith. Okay, can you do this with me? Some of you, this will be very familiar. Others, maybe not so much. Paul says in Romans 3:19 that the law stops the mouth of the unbeliever. It gets the person that loves to justify himself and say, no, I am good, I have passed the test, I'm not avoiding the test, I have passed the test, okay? Check this out. The test is personal. Do you consider yourself to be a good person? Do you? For the most part, yeah, right? Most people think, I am a good person. Okay, do you keep the Ten Commandments? Now, there is, of course, another discussion about whether or not you keep the commandments. Don't go there. I don't think you keep the commandments in order to get saved. That's legalism. But you note that Paul says to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 1 that the law is given to the unbeliever, and he confronts them with a bunch of things. So let me ask you a couple. Have you ever told a lie before? I'm looking for some interaction here. Yes, okay. What does that make you? Makes you a liar. Okay, but you're a good person, right? Well, basically, when I compare myself to others, okay. Have you ever stolen something before? What does that make you? Right, not a stealer, right? Not a football team, a thief, right? Okay, so you're a liar and you're a thief. Have you ever used the Lord's name in vain? Use the name of God like a four-letter curse word. Yeah, what does that make you? A blasphemer. I've just gone through three. Have you ever lusted before? Looked at someone that doesn't belong to you and said, I want that for me? Oh, man, this is where it gets even, ouch. Yep, that, yep. What does that make me? According to Matthew 5, it says I'm an adulterer. I'm an adulterer of heart. Have you ever killed anybody? Ever murdered anybody? Not everyone that's done this will readily admit it, right? But the truth is, again in Matthew 5, it says, if you look at someone with hatred in your heart, it's the same as murder of heart. In other words, I'm looking at you, if you have a brother or a sister, then you've done this, okay? If you have a relative. So we go through this, and how are you doing? Well, I'm a good person, basically, but I am a liar, I'm a thief, I'm a blasphemer, I've committed adultery in my heart and murdered people in my heart. If not having done those things literally, how am I now doing if I stand before a righteous God? And he says, why should I let you into my heaven? Oh, because I'm good. Or I tried. I may be messed up, but I changed now. Think about going to the court of law and the judge says, you're guilty of a crime. You need to pay up, and this is your fine. You need to go X number of years in prison or X amount of money. And you say, no, judge, see, I've changed my ways. I'm totally a reformed person. Is the judge going to say, well, I didn't know that. Thanks for telling me. You're free to go. No, he's going to say, too bad you go to jail. Too bad you pay your fine. It's the same thing with our sin. See, we think that we're doing okay, but we're really not doing as well as we think we are. If we've done all those things, we stand before a holy God, we have a problem. We are sinners. And he is a holy, righteous God. Let me just let that sink into you for a second. I think too many times we talk about, do you want to go to heaven? You ever heard people talk about, you want to go to heaven? Who doesn't want to go to heaven? I mean, I want to go to heaven if it's real, right? Most people, when you talk to them about heaven, they're like, is it real? Is God real? Is the Bible real? But in their heart of hearts, they realize that there is something bigger than themselves. And they have a longing to be connected to him. And I'm telling you that you cannot get connected to him by good works, by going to church, by giving money, by having a food pantry, by doing a variety of things. You can't do it in and of your own effort. But there is hope. Okay? We're going to talk about that secondly. It's personal, but it's also factual. I want you to look at the facts of what this test is all involved. As to whether you're in the faith. Okay, so to be in the faith here is a reference that's found five times in the New Testament, and it's talking about the subjective side of actually living out your life in a way that pleases God. Okay, so it is evidence that, yes, I say I'm a believer, but does your walk match your talk? That's where it gets really personal, because you might claim to be one thing, but then when you get into the heat of the moment, perhaps something else comes out of you, and it's not the fruit of the Spirit, and you might say, oh man, I'm in trouble now. Am I in the faith? The good news is it's not just that you are choosing to be in the faith, but that Jesus chooses to be in you. And I love how Paul includes these two. So it's a choice, but it's also something that God does in drawing you to himself. That Jesus Christ is in you. And if you put this together, what he is talking about, he's talking about the fact of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is not a gimmick in order to pass the test. What you do is you need to embrace the message of the gospel, the good news. The way I'd like to describe it to you is in this order. What is the gospel? Well, the word means good news. We're preaching something that's good. Consider it as a story form. Okay, and I love this approach because it's the gospel in narrative. Most people love stories. And so here we go with the story. It starts out with creation, which is a little hard perhaps to read, but it starts out with God created in the beginning everything good. We can rejoice in that. It wasn't bad when it started. It was all good. But then there was a curse. And the curse happened when Adam chose his wife over God. And when that happened, this great cloud came over all of the earth, impacting everything from thorns coming out to pain in childbearing for the women, to a serpent crawling on the dust, in the dust on its belly for all of its days, even in the millennial kingdom, it says, which that poor serpent, every other curse is lifted except for the serpents. Look at Isaiah 65 sometime. It's a bad thing, and because of that thing, we have a need. It's Christ. Right after the curse happens, Genesis 3:15 gives us the first example of the good news. There is going to be the seed of a woman that crushes the head of a serpent. And that's a picture of Jesus. Because there's all these offers in this hope that Jesus is one day coming. The Messiah is coming. So they have kings. But they all end up messing up somehow. They have different opportunities for prophets to lead the charge, and they end up messing up, and God's people ends up messing up, the people of Israel. So what we're longing for is Christ. That's where the New Testament starts off. Jesus coming. He is perfect Son of God. And yet he came in the flesh as a human so that he could relate with you and with me. At every point of temptation, Jesus knows what it feels like. If you're lonely, call out to Christ. He knows what you feel like. In fact, he knew greater loneliness than anyone could ever experience on the cross when he said, "Father, Father, why are you turning from me?" He knows what it's like to suffer from the oppression of others around him and getting wronged. Have you ever been wronged? I have. Jesus knows. Call out to him. He knows every point of temptation that you would face, the temptation to covet things, to want more, to bring pleasure to yourself, the temptation to change your circumstances because it's in your power to do something, but you know it's not God's will. But he submitted to God's will. This is the Christ. He's perfect Son of God, and then we have the cross. And the beauty of this is that Jesus bore your sin on the cross. He did that because of his great love for you. So understand what I'm saying. All of that list that we went through about having lied, stolen, blasphemed, and we could go on and on. Actually, James says, if you offend in one point, you're guilty of all of those. So it doesn't matter. There's no one that is worse off than another. We're all in a bad condition apart from Jesus Christ. But Jesus took your sin, every bit of it. Colossians 2 says, past, present, and future. He took all of it upon himself. That is reason to rejoice. Please understand this. No one is outside of the possibility of embracing the truth of the gospel, and we have an opportunity for recreation. What was distorted in the image-bearing that we experienced at the very beginning is restored shade by shade, as it speaks of in this very book that we're looking at, one shade of glory to the next shade of glory. What a glorious thought. So you can, as Pastor said this morning, start afresh today. God's mercies are new every morning. Great is his faithfulness. This is the good news of the gospel, and it leads us finally to this call for commitment. It's this test. It's a choice that you have to make. Because this is good news, but it's only really good if you take it as your own. If you just look at it and say, that's a beautiful thought, beautiful concept, yeah, it's superior to what all these other religions say, but is it yours? You have to receive Christ. Christ has to come in you. Are you in the faith? Is Christ in you? How will you respond to the gospel? I hope that you choose tonight to respond in joy over what you have received, and I hope you choose to respond in a way that is a great delight if you haven't come to Christ, that tonight's the night that you turn to Christ. Here's the last thing. You've been very good, okay? Personal, factual, I want you to understand it's unavoidable. Now notice this. You cannot avoid this. Paul says at the very end, unless indeed you are disqualified. What does it tell us? That it's very possible that that they're in this group, there's someone in here that has been in the process of faking other people out for a very, very long time. and you're going to be found disqualified. It's not disqualified by your pastor, it's disqualified by Christ, who is the great judge. There is a judgment day coming. It's appointed unto men once to die, and after that, the judgment. That day is coming. Are you going to be qualified? This is serious. You can't avoid it. So what are you going to do with this? This is the point of what Paul is saying, and he is hopeful, as we've seen already in verse 6, that you would actually pass this test. But the judgment day is clearly coming. Now, as I think about this, let me put it to you in these words. A colleague of mine at Bob Jones University preached a sermon about how 2 Corinthians 5:17, old things have passed away, behold, all things have become new. His name is Greg Mazak. And he made this statement. He said that dogs bark, we expect the dog to bark. Four-leaf clover, we expect to bark when he sees ponies. And that's exactly what happened last night. As we had ponies here for our activity, we had this beautiful dog here, and he was going crazy. And that's what we expect from a dog. I saw a falcon, a hawk, come down here on the fence right across the street from the church. I have it on a picture on my phone. Fact. What do I expect that falcon to do? First, I don't expect a big hawk to show up in the middle of North Minneapolis, but nonetheless, there it was. What do I expect a bird to do when I say boo? What does a bird do? It flies. And that's exactly what it did. What do you expect the baby to do? Cry. And we've seen babies cry. From my own, which he's not quite a baby, but I've seen him cry, to others. What are Christians supposed to do? Grow. Christians grow. If you're really a believer, if you've passed this test, it doesn't mean you're going to be perfect, but it does mean that you're going to be in the process of growing. Christians grow. Christians don't fall back. Christians grow. Now, here's the reality. We go through tough times. I know from testimonies and from knowing some of you that there are ups and downs. I have them as well. That doesn't mean I'm not a Christian if I go through a down. It just means that I'm walking away from the Lord. Pastor said that, Dad said that this morning. He said, there's no such thing as a plateau. And that's what I'm saying to you. A Christian's going to grow. You can grow as a result of the difficulty you went through, right? But you're going to grow. You're going to look back and say, by God's grace, this is where I am today because he has been so good. Christians grow. They want to spend time with God. They want to spend time with believers. They want to spend time sharing the gospel with those around you. The very thing that you heard this morning, this should be you. Is it you? Is that where you find yourself? Or are you in the category of the Hebrews 3, Hebrews 4, or James 5? Have you heard of Charles Spurgeon? Okay, I'm going to wrap this up with this thought, okay? Narrative, story. You ever wondered how he came to Christ? How he converted? I want you to listen to this. C.H. Spurgeon from the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London was born in Kelvedon, Essex in 1834. He was converted in January 1850 at the age of 15. At Colchester, he gave his first gospel address at Faversham when he was 16. And for 30 years, this man declared almost weekly to audiences numbering 5 or 6,000 the glorious gospel of the blessed God. Millions of sermons have been scattered in all parts of the world. He quietly passed into heaven on Sunday, January 3rd, 1892. Would you like to know how such a man got saved? Obviously, he was gifted in a unique way, and people saw that giftedness, and God blessed that. This is how he said, his description. I sometimes think I might have been in darkness and despair now had it not been for the goodness of God in sending a snowstorm one Sunday morning when I was going to a place of worship. When I could go no further, I turned down a court and came to a little primitive Methodist chapel. In the chapel, there might have been a dozen or 15 people. The minister did not come that morning. Snowed up, I suppose. A poor man, a shoemaker, a tailor, or something of that sort, went up to the pulpit to preach. He was obliged to stick to his text for the simple reason that he had nothing else to say. The text was, "Look unto me and be saved, all the ends of the earth." He did not even pronounce the words rightly, but that did not matter. There was, I thought, a glimpse of hope for me in that text. He began thus, "My dear friends, This is a very simple text indeed. It says, look. Now, that does not take a deal of effort. It ain't lifting your foot or your finger. It just is to look. Well, a man need not go to college to learn to look. You may be the biggest fool, and yet you can look. A man need not be worth $1,000 a year to look. Anyone can look. A child can look. But this is what the text says. Then he says, look unto me. I, said he, in broad Essex, many of ye are looking to yourselves. No use looking there. You'll never find comfort in yourselves. Then the good man followed up his text in this way. Look unto me. I'm sweating great drops of blood. Look unto me. I'm hanging on the cross. Look. I'm dead and buried. Look unto me. I rise again. Look unto me. I ascend. I'm sitting at the Father's right hand. Oh, look to me. Look to me. When he had about that length and managed to spin out 10 minutes, he was at the length of his tether. Then he looked at me under the gallery, and I dare say, with so few present, he knew me to be a stranger. He then said, young man, you look very miserable. Well, I did, but I had not been accustomed to have remarks made on my personal appearance from the pulpit before. However, it was a good blow struck. He continued, and you will always be miserable, miserable in life and miserable in death if you do not obey my text. But if you obey now, this moment, you will be saved. Then he shouted, as only a primitive Methodist can, young man, look to Jesus Christ. There and then the cloud was gone, the darkness had rolled away, and that moment I saw the sun. I could have risen that moment and sung with the most enthusiastic of them of the precious blood of Christ. Have you done that? Have you done that ever? If you haven't, tonight's the night. Look to Christ. Pass this test. If you have, are you that excited about the gospel of Jesus Christ that you're ready to sing about it? That you can't wait to get into your Bible tomorrow morning when the alarm goes off before you start your day? Are you that excited? Christians grow, and Christians demonstrate. Let's see whether or not we are qualified. God, I pray that you would take